encouragement. Thank you, Eva. All right, so tonight we're exploring sukha, or happiness. So this is in the context of this transcendental origination. So if you're just kind of joining us now or catching up, this is a process that the Buddha used to describe the liberation of the heart and mind. It's really it's not really an opposition, but it's like an alternative to how we usually stay in the cycle of suffering through dependent origination and the aggregates, all these ways that we create that sense of self and how that sense of self ties us to suffering, this added on suffering, this additional unnecessary suffering. And they both start in suffering, but in dependent or this transcendental dependent origination, it goes into from suffering into faith, and from faith it goes into a quality of joy, and then that joy changes into a quality of rapture. Then tranquility is kind of the counterbalancing, and then this month we come into happiness, this quality of happiness that's a different happiness than we're used to in this culture. Like happiness is so conditioned in our lives. I'm happy if I have the right people around me, the right circumstances, the right experiences, and unhappy when those go away. So it's really tied to the conditions. You know, that's part of our jargon in this tradition. The conditions are the circumstances, the details of your life, the past history, the past choices that kind of lead to this moment's experience. Now it's interesting that happiness, tonight's this month, next month it goes to concentration, which is kind of a more hardcore meditative quality. And that hardcoreness of it just, it's more of a uniting of the mind, a sense of the mind really becoming collected. Now that collectedness, often we approach it from a place of effort, of trying to get someplace special, you know, attain those jhanas or attain those meditative states. And yet happiness is the best precursor to that, the brightness of the mind, the brightness of the heart. So that allows our minds to soften, to relax, and concentration is a much more natural expression of that. So happiness, in the context of our Dharma practice, is really pointing to the happiness that's outside of the conditions and circumstances, the details of our life. And this is, it's hard, I think, initially to get a sense of that. Because of course we have preferences. Of course we want to have, you know, enough food to eat. We want to have shelter. We want to have loved ones around us. Be free of pain. These are natural human preferences. And yet practice can start to show us this happiness that's outside of those conditions, outside of the circumstances. This is part of the reason it's, you know, our technique is a little bit austere, right? We don't do like Sufi and dancing all over the place and spinning, or we are simply sitting with ourselves, sitting still with this moment's experience. So that austere container allows us to start to learn this capacity to open to the difficult and also start to see the happiness that can be outside of those conditions. Happiness of however my mind and body is looking and feeling in this moment. Tonight I like to use a poem, actually. Sometimes I like to teach from a poem because it brings out a different understanding through the poet's words of how do we relate to our practice, how does our heart come forth in it, and use this to teach around this topic of happiness. So the poet is Naomi Shihab Nye, and the poem is So Much Happiness. It is difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there is something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands, like ticket stubs or change. But happiness floats. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house singing and disappears when it wants to. You are happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches. And love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and scratched records. Since there is no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug. You raise your hands and it flows out of you, into everything you touch. You are not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. So I will use this poem to kind of bring forth some points. You know, I think the poem is stands alone, and we could just call it an early night, but I'll go ahead and try to bring some interpretation or bring some of these pieces alive. Now, the very first part kind of sets up this whole important dynamic around happiness that we often have, and also around our suffering, kind of our attachment to our suffering. Our suffering gives us something to do. It orients us in often a profound way. And yet sometimes that orientation gets in our way as Dharma practitioners, because we are used to working on ourselves, working on our minds, working on this difficult thing. And sometimes, I see this in retreats especially, because sometimes in people's practices, the kind of backlog of unresolved issues, of struggle, kind of falls away. And they come on the retreat after having so many years of practicing with their grief, with their anger, with their mind states, with the hindrances. And they come on the retreat and it's actually kind of quiet. It's kind of still. And they're like, I don't know what to do. I'm used to kind of fighting with myself, struggling with myself. And then the release of once you see through that and there's a peace from that. We actually come on the retreat and you're already in peace. What do you do? How do you practice? So Naomi talks about this in this way. It's difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there's something to rub against. A wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands, like ticket stubs or change. Meditation practice teaches us how to pick up those pieces, right? How to pick up those parts. Perhaps if you reflect on when you first came to practice, maybe it was your suffering became intolerable. You couldn't find a way through it through all your normal ways. That's how I actually came to the practice. I was in the grips of the grief of a relationship, committed relationship that was dissolving, was ending, and feeling that deep pain of that deep sorrow of that, and that deep fear and anger and all those qualities. And it was very, very difficult for that young age of some 26 or so. And I started to hear the Dharma, and the Dharma pointed to the capacity, the potential anyway, to be happy or have a sense of ease, at least a sense of peace, even in the midst of these circumstances. The teacher I heard said it this way, that your experience that you're having, whether it's a big experience or a small experience, when you multiply your resistance by that experience, that equals how much suffering you're going to feel, how much suffering you're going to experience. And so if I had very little resistance to this experience, there'd be very little suffering. If I had no resistance, there'd be no suffering. And as I heard that, I was like, well, that sounds good. That I maybe have some way of meeting this experience that I felt so helpless in and so overwhelmed by it. Is how can I actually use my mind, use my attention, use the techniques of the Dharma to meet this? And so I think many of us have some level of suffering that brought us to practice. And maybe, it's, you know, of course, life isn't always happy. And we have these losses. We have these physical pain, these mental pains, these these fears of the future, the fears of the country, all these things make it hard to practice, make us hard to be in the practice, but yet we find the practice is this beautiful respite that we can come into. We learn to, okay, I can rely on the practice to meet this experience, to give me space around it. And so we learn how to meet this moment with wisdom, with compassion, and there's tremendous growth and learning that comes from that. There's a tremendous confidence that starts to come from meeting our own difficulties, our own suffering, our own sorrows, and meeting others with clarity, with compassion, with presence. And there's this subtle habit that we may not realize, or perspective, that we feel more, is this double-edged sword, because on one hand, it's so helpful to have this sense of self-empowerment, this capacity that, okay, I can meet this. I can meet what's going to arise, or at least I will learn how to. I won't be devastated. I may be really shooken up, but at least I can find my way back. And there's also this subtle way that the sense of self feels more secure in that. It has this new tool that we can bring forth, this new tool of how to meet this experience. And then this is the rub, is that when life is easy, when life is going well, when life is beautiful, and we have, or maybe we're just fallen to this place of ease and stillness in our minds, regardless of circumstances. Sometimes we're a little disconcerted by that. We're a little bit troubled by the fact there's no trouble. Right? If I had some trouble, then I know what to do with it. I know how to pick up the pieces. I know how to put lotion over these wounds. The Buddha, in one of his analogies, is the raft. So the raft is a really concrete, powerful analogy, because we build this raft of our techniques, of our intentions, of our knowledge to go across this flood, this raging river of suffering. And it's really necessary to develop that. It's necessary to develop this quality of steadiness of mind and heart to be able to open to the pain of our lives and the pain of the world. And so it looks like the meditative techniques, like the intro class we just finished, learning those, going on retreats, all the different Dharma study that we do. And it all kind of creates this beautiful raft that we can use to start to cross that flood. But the Buddha said, once you've crossed that flood, you don't need to carry the raft anymore. But yet we tend to. We carry that raft, partly because it's habit, it's what we've known, but also because we are really formed around that. The sense of me is really identified with that technique, with that raftness, if you will. And this is the subtle aspect of practice, that at some point, it becomes almost a motorcycle going by. I know it was online, there's some motorcycles with muffler's not working quite so well. There's this kind of, what's the right word for it? There's a point of, I guess, a moment of truth, if you will, that we realize that our practice, the sense of me as the meditator, that perspective of which has served me so well, becomes what actually is in my way. It actually limits me. Just as if I cross the flood with the raft, I'm trying to carry this big raft on my head or on my shoulders, I won't be able to explore that terrain in the same way. And a big key piece of this is that sense of me, that sense of self that still believed it. Right? Sense of self is one of those core teachings of the Buddha, core teachings of the Dharma, but also one which is, I think a lot of us scratch our heads on it, or get kind of confused about it, or misunderstand what it really means. Right? That sense of self is, this is the one way to make it easier to understand, is that there's a sense of self which is relatively true. Right? There's this perspective of me having this experience. If we look at ourselves developmentally as a young child, as a, as a baby, actually, the baby wakes, comes into the world, they're distinguished from their mother, from their surroundings. There's just a sense of connection. There's a sense of oneness, right? At some point, that child to develop has to learn how to be me, to be something separate. See that often expressed at the two-year-old stage when they say they learn the word no. And they start to exert themselves and start to have that sense of autonomy. They're separating from their mother, from their parents. They're developing their whole sense of self. And we go through this journey. Sometimes it's hurt by trauma, hurt by abuse, hurt by neglect. And yet each one of us, we have this kind of this first task of learning to have a healthy sense of self, or at least healthy enough. A sense of self that has enough self-esteem, a enough sense of ease in ourselves. Okay, and then we can start to explore the Dharma. It's like, okay, what's this absolute nature of self? Because there's at some point we realize that sense of self ties us subtly into suffering. Even when there's something like this project of being a meditator, turning toward experience with skill. So it's difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands, like ticket stubs or change. It's putting things back together. It's like that Humpty Dumpty putting ourselves back together. So Naomi, I have never talked to her. I don't know her Dharma understanding, but it comes through in these poems very strongly. And what she says next is that happiness flows. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Now, happiness, when it floats, it doesn't need you to hold it down, doesn't need anything. That points to this conditionality that we often place on it, and realizing when we free it from that conditionality, we free it from the sense of ownership, like this is my happiness, that actually amplifies. It actually becomes much bigger than us. It starts to spread beyond us. And that's the happiness. Remember, transcendental dependent origination is pointing toward this deep liberation of the heart. This quality of awakening, this experience, this knowing of awakening. So happiness floats in this sense of being expansive, being untethered. It's difficult to know what to do with it because we're used to having something project. We realize we can't actually hold on to it. We can't claim it as I or me or mine. So happiness lands on the roof of the next house singing and disappears when it wants to. And you're happy either way. You're happy either way. I think this is one of the pieces of happiness that we get to kind of get the reality check. Because we can feel like, okay, I've got this. Happiness is great. And then, we get bad news or someone honks their horn at us or the motorcycle gang goes by the center and rattles the windows or whatever it might be. And we can realize maybe how fragile that happiness was, how really it was based on the conditions. And that point of that moment when you notice that is such an important point of practice and what you do next with that. So many of us, when we find that, okay, I lost my happiness, it disappeared, I thought it was so stable, and then my spouse and my partner yelled at me, or I messed up on this thing at work, whatever it might be, and we find that happiness disappears, and we say, oh, I'm not such a good meditator, after all. I don't know what I'm doing. There's doubt that comes in. There's a self-aversion and judgment that comes in. Here's a secret. It's like once you can learn to turn that around is actually an opportunity to understand. Oh, that's really interesting that happiness that seems so stable went out the window in an instant with this one change of circumstances. Right? So then you have a chance to, if I don't judge myself, if I don't judge my practice, that I actually can practice with it. I can actually turn toward it and say, what is this? What happened here? What's this experience like? And compassion is so helpful to this. Oh, this is a painful piece here. This is a painful experience. This is not how I want this moment to be. I can start to understand some of the deeper ways that I claim ownership of something I can't really claim ownership of. This happiness isn't yours, it's not mine, and yet it's fully here. Naomi goes on to say, even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Cannot make you unhappy. I mean, to be honest, that would make me unhappy at times, right? And yet, life asks us, how do we practice with that? How do we actually meet that? How do we let go of that remorse and that regret? There's a story I heard early on in my practice. That same teacher was a cassette course on insight meditation. And he shared this story of this individual who wanted to go practice in a very deep quiet, deep solitude, and really go into the kind of the darkness of that time of years around the holiday season. It was someplace in Asia. And so he found this beautiful cave that was really secluded and had enough food. He was all set up and sat down. Okay, finally I can practice without distractions. But there's a village nearby, and the village wanted to celebrate Christmas. And so they started to play Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Okay? And they only had that one record. And they had loudspeakers so everyone could enjoy it. And they played it over and over and over and over and over again. And so he's practicing, and of course, his first reaction is, this is not what I wanted. This is terrible. This is going to ruin my practice. And yet the song kept going. And so then he practiced, he got to meet all the aversion, all the ill will, all the anger around it, all the disappointment, until finally he started actually listening to the song and said, well, they weren't really nice to Rudolph, were they? You know, like compassion came out. It's like, wow, this is really a hard, sad song for Rudolph. And then the joy of when things change, when he actually was seen for his gifts to Santa. And if you've been practicing for a while, or if you've had the kind of the mixed benefit or the opportunity of having to practice with something which is not what you want, but still you get to be with it. You still get to live with it. It could be something really like a neighbor making sounds like that, or it could be a circumstance. On retreats, we often get this with, if someone in the hall is maybe making noise that people don't like, or there's wrestling or something, sometimes there's such a fragility around what makes you tranquil, what makes you happy. And yet, you keep practicing with it until at some point something shifts, something lets go. And that's when you allow happiness to float. You allow happiness to have its own expression. And you realize that even though you once lived over a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. The followers of the Buddha, it was a sutta where I think a prince was just remarking to the Buddha that he could always tell who his followers were, because you know their expressions were content, they had a kind of a quiet happiness, a quiet peace. Right? And I think sometimes we miss something in translation because we tend to be a little dour, especially on retreats. Everyone's very serious and self-focused, right? But yet there's this happiness that defines the practice and its essence. This next line, everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches. and love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and the scratched records. So everything has a life of its own. You can hear how there's a quality of equanimity which comes in to support happiness, an equanimity that's equally near all things. So, you know, one of the Brahma Viharas coming in to support this happiness, to realize, okay, life has its own timing, its own expression. And, you know, those of you who are parents or grandparents, you know how it's a challenge to let go of your agenda for your child, to allow your child to have their own life, their own choices, their own mistakes, their own heartaches and failures, because we want them not to have that, right? But yet, that's part of life, and that's this perspective. I remember when my daughter was 3 or so and had a crayon. She had a set of crayons, were kind of really, you know, the big ones that young kids can hold, and one cracked or broke, and she was so devastated by this. She was just sobbing with pain over this, and I found the part. My initial response was, "Oh, I wish I could take that pain away. I wish she would never have to feel pain in her whole life." But then the next thought was like, "Well, that would be a big disservice for her. You know, it's good to learn how to be with a broken crayon before you have to be with a broken heart." So love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and the scratch records. So this is a happiness which it's been interesting exploring this month. How do we find that happiness? Where is that happiness outside of conditions? Sometimes you notice where it's not, where it's absent, and say, okay, what's the mind state? What's the assumptions of self and other that help maintain that lack of happiness? I think so much of this is the letting go and meeting life just how it is, letting life have its own expression. Since there's no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug. You raise your hands and it flows out of you into everything you touch. Since there's no place large enough to contain so much happiness, like we can't contain it within ourselves. The happiness that's really conditioned, that's based on the conditions of my life, we can kind of defend against it. We can protect it, you know, not trying to let it go away, try to push away things which threaten that happiness. But the kind of happiness that Naomi is pointing toward and the happiness that the Dharma is pointing toward is much bigger than you or me. It's not contained by anything. And then we're able to let go of this contraction around it to actually allow it to flow out of us. And there's a sense of surrender. You shrug. You raise your hands and it flows out of you into everything you touch. And everything we touch is this engagement to life. You know, how we can meet. You know, those of you who have been on retreat or have done an extended practice, there's often this kind of sweet time right after the retreat where you're very different in the world. There's a quality of sensitivity, a quality of kindness, a quality of meeting a complete stranger in a way that I don't know what they think of us when we're like that. But I can tell that they appreciate that. There's a sense of really listening, that point of contact. There's a stillness instead of being, you often kind of leading through our irritation, our busyness, and people are kind of in the way. Like, you know, the cashier, like, just hurry up and check me out, instead of actually connecting with them. And there was a really sweet moments that we were letting that happiness is flowing out of us into everything that we touch. You shrug and you raise your hands and it flows out of you into everything you touch. And then finally, you are not responsible. You take no credit, as a night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. So this is kind of that, these all these subtle things that she's pointing toward. How we sometimes think, "Wow, I'm really happy. You know, aren't I a good meditator? I'm really doing a good job at this." You know, there's a little pride that comes up, a little ownership around it. And yet, you know, the Dharma has kind of a, I don't know, it's a safety feature or a way that it, those patterns kind of run out of steam. They stop working. We start to see through them. And in that seeing through, there's, okay, I'm not responsible. I can't take credit for this happiness. And this image of the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but yet continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. All right, so I'm just going to read that poem one more time, and then we can sit for a second. So Much Happiness by Naomi Shihab Nye. It's difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there is something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands like ticket stubs or change. But happiness flows. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house singing and disappears when it wants to. You are happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches, and love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and scratched records. Since there is no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug. You raise your hands and it flows out of you into everything you touch. You are not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it. And in that way, be known. All right, let's just sit together for a few moments. Sensing into this happiness, it's not yours, it's not anyone's. Too big to hold, and yet we can still express it, experience it, outside of conditions. All right, we have some space for any questions or sharing. So again, as usual in the room, we can grab the mic so we can hear you online. Online, you can just raise your virtual hand and we can all hear you. Questions about happiness, the lack of happiness, questions about Dharma. Yeah, Deborah.
Yeah, I think I kind of get the idea of happiness independent of conditions, but I really have a hard time applying this, having, what's the relevance of this teaching in extreme conditions, wartime, poverty, incarceration, torture. I mean, all the things that, you know, is it, you know, where, what do we do with this teaching when conditions are inescapable and horrible?
Yeah, that's actually where the happiness is. I think it's just really, we really find it. That's outside of conditions, because the circumstances are so terrible. They're so fearful, so much pain around that. And yet the mind can still find that place of happiness. And that's, you know, there's different people who've written of this. You know, Viktor Frankl talked about this from the place of the concentration camps. You know, how did he find that sense of wholeness of mind, of heart, even in the midst of all these these horrors, in the midst of a disaster. And so sometimes it just arises, like in times when I've had, you know, short-term, very personal loss or personal fear and grief, sometimes it's so strong, it's so powerful that all my normal strategies don't work. Yeah, they're helpless against it. And sometimes that throws us into this place of stillness, of actually opening to what is around us. You know, it might be the beauty of nature, if we can see it, or it might be something very simple that we can see and connect with, or just even that quality of it's there, you know, because it's not dependent upon conditions. It's hard to think about that, to find that, but yet it can arise. And that's some of the biggest tests for our practice or challenges for our practice. But yet it's still possible. Doesn't mean we don't, you know, it's a horrible situation. Doesn't make that go away. It's not like we care, you know, we don't care about the suffering in ourselves are experiencing, those around us. But there's also this happiness. I think that's one of the pieces, to use inspiration of Kuan Yin, is that hearing the 10,000 cries of the world, but also the 10,000 joys of the world. So there's this balance of attention that starts to arise. So it's one of those things that you can look for, you can practice with, and notice also where the absence of it is. So my mind, the same exact circumstance, I can go into a place of real contraction around it, in that place of future tripping and past remorsing, and lose that contact of that quality of buoyancy. And so happiness is not like I'm going to be laughing and giggling, but more as if almost like a sense of peace, a little bit of ease in the midst of that experience. All right, go ahead, Kathy.
Thank you. This is such a rich and nuanced bunch of stuff to digest, and I appreciate that so much. I'm just finding in myself a question to do with being stoic, stoicism. If you might, I'd just be curious about your take on that, how you thread that one.
And how stoicism kind of relates to this whole topic of happiness, or just in general?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Like in the face of suffering, I might be tempted, or one might be tempted to just kind of grit your teeth and bite down and determine to get through it, rather than what you're saying here is so much more subtle and lightly held. This happiness is not. I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, honestly.
Okay, well, I'll talk around a little bit, see if it meets what you're talking about. So the sense of stoicism, it's often a learned behavior, learned expression, and it often has where did you go, Kathy?
Oh,
there you are. Okay. It's sometimes on Zoom, like I'm focusing on someone and I think someone opens a video, closes the video, and then suddenly I lose eye contact. I'm like, where did they go? So stoicism, like for myself, I remember this very distinctly when I was early in my retreat practice history. I would try to sit still in the midst of the hall, even though my body was really rebelling against that. There's a lot of physical pain and tightness because I'm not a very flexible person. And yet I would say, okay, I'm gonna sit with this. I'm gonna try to relax with this and open to this. But there's a lot of that was the stoicism, or that being just, okay, I'm gonna just hold this and be with this. And as I look back, there was kind of this overlay of how I thought I should be, how my experience should be, kind of what I thought was the right way of practicing. And at some point, I realized that very pattern was going against, was not helping me. And the way I noticed it is I heard the bell calling us back from a walking period. And I noticed that there was a fear response right in that moment. There's sound and then fear about going back in the hall. I was like, okay, I don't think this is the right way to be practicing. And I realized what was needed was to let go of my agenda of how I thought I should be practicing, how I should look, to actually have compassion. Compassion for this body, compassion for this moment. To realize, okay, it's actually, I can have much more depth of practice if I just gently shifted my body, shifted my mind. And so a sense of being attuned with how things are versus how we think they should be. You know, I see this with in retreat practice with students. Sometimes people are really suffering, you know, forcing themselves into the lotus position or just sitting on the floor because, you know, all the statues of the Buddha is sitting, and, you know, all the good practitioners, the real profound practitioners, the ones sitting on the floor is how the mind story is going, right? But yet when I can finally talk them into sitting in a chair, they sometimes are like, whoa, you know, I suddenly have all this energy freed up to actually be present, to actually meet this moment. So stoicness, there's often a belief that's driving it. There's a concept of how I should be, how the moment should be, and I'm kind of forcing myself through it. And there's times we have to have that kind of endurance and that perseverance. But a lot of times it's more of an attitude that kind of gets in our way.
Yeah. There it is again, our sense of self, our self expectations. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Kathy. Go ahead, Nina.
Hi, Tim. Hi, Sangha. Thank you for the beautiful poem. Just a comment about what resonated with me in the poem is when she writes, and then you shrug. And for me, I can relate to that moment of, giving up, letting go. We have a word for it in the Dharma. I forgot what it is. Renunciation.
Mm.
It's a renunciation. And so it's like, you know, in these times it's really, really hard, you know, I do find that I can still have a happiness in me because I can't control everything.
Mm.
I have no control over what's happening. And as you said, you know, look into nature and our families or just knowing that we can let go of it. That's it.
Thank you, Nina. Yeah, it's such a good pointing toward that sense, yeah, renunciation, that letting go, that releasing, and so much that's what keeps happiness apart from us is like, okay, I'm still clinging to this or holding on to this. And that sense of surrender, that sense of letting go, then happiness often reveals itself at that moment. All right. I'm going to come back to you online. Let's just see if there's anyone here in the room who wanted to share or ask anything. Yeah, Beth.
I'm not totally sure if this is a question or just sort of a comment following on from what Nina was saying, but there's something sort of outside of the world of Dharma that when I am experiencing this happiness that's maybe not conditioned, I notice I'm not very interesting. Mm. It feels like there's sort of a friction there of somebody close to me maybe ask, how are you doing? What's going on? What they kind of want to hear is like, what's it irritating you? Or do you want to have like kind of a little bitch session or something? And when things are just okay, or like maybe even if things aren't okay, but I'm okay with them not being okay.
Mm.
That sort of answer lands flat. And so I don't know. I guess I just kind of wanted to bring that up and hear what your thoughts were about, like, oh, now I'm just not quite as interesting as I used to be.
Well, it's part of the, you know, there's studies around systems, you know, like if you have a system of, whether it's a physical system or a system of people or culture or, you know, group of friends, the system kind of has a set of rules on how everything works, like cogs in a wheel. And one of their cogs gets out and stops, you know, complaining about things and gossiping and all those things. The system kind of wants to get it back into that hole. And that's kind of the one way of seeing how the Buddha talked about this practice is like against the stream, like going against the flow of our culture, of our life. Because there is that way that, you know, people like to gossip. They like to, you know, complain. They like to find what's wrong. And there's kind of that addiction to the drama of things. And yeah, if you're not, you may not be as interesting if you're just that happiness or that sense of ease. Part of it may be too is like, how do we find words for that? How do we kind of let that be expressed? And can we be happy even if people think we're boring? Yeah, so sometimes finding words to express, you know, just the simple delight in things. And, you know, people may be not like quite know what that means or what you're talking about, but it can also be a little bit of a pointing, a little bit of a seed around that. And that's how, as practitioners, we really are messengers of the Dharma. Even if we never tell anyone we're practicing, there's a way that we are behaving or acting in a different way. And there's also the, next month is concentration. The month after that is seeing things how, as they are. And there's the next month after that is disillusionment. And that's part of what you're talking about too, is that you just don't have the drive or that you just don't care about the drama in the same way. You don't care about the struggle in the same way. And that's part of this disillusionment. You start to see that adding energy to that isn't what you want to do anymore. And so it starts to fall away. And people who are kind of oriented around bringing energy to it, yeah, there's kind of a turbulence or the system's kind of like sure what to do. So it's, yeah, being true to yourself and finding ways to still engage with people. All right, let's go to Kamel.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, I was just curious if you could maybe define the difference between joy and happiness a little bit more. You might have touched on it, but I didn't quite get it.
Sure. Yeah, so joy versus happiness, how do those relate? So joy, the way I'm holding it right now, you know, in terms of this particular list of the transcendental divergentation, is joy has this quality of it's almost this excitement. There's this kind of buoyancy to it. There's a enliveness to it. And remember, it comes after faith. It's like you see there's this possibility of suffering not being so so mandatory. There's actually a way that I can see through my suffering. And there's often a joy that comes from that, the joy of seeing the Dharma, joy of the potential of that Dharma, the kind of the brightness and excitement of practice. And we often go through that kind of bright faith and the joy of that when you first hear the Dharma. We get really jazzed by it. We're really engaged with it. There's kind of this boundless energy around it. Well, happiness is kind of a maturity of that, and at least we're going to talk about it right now. I may change my answer in the future. But there's a sense of happiness that's kind of less conditioned. I think joy maybe has that excitement of something new or that excitement of that potential. And there's a higher frequency. While this kind of happiness is more, it's more maybe aligned with what we call peace or a quality of calmness, but there's also a sense of well-being. So it has tranquility as part of it, but there's also this quality of just ease with the circumstances. And there's a sense of happiness with with this circumstance or that circumstance. There's a happiness that's so not so much dependent upon the circumstances.
That's really helpful. Thank you for doing that.
You're welcome. All right, let's just toggle back and forth. Let's go online, in person, and we'll come back to Walded in a second.
Okay. Hello? Okay, there we go. My name is Jeremy. I was struck most by the part of the poem that was something along the lines of, like, the happiness in, like, the floor that needs to be swept, things like that. All of these things that are dirty, need work, things like that. Because my reaction to that was not just, like, wow, I'm so far away from finding happiness in that. It was actually that, like, that seems impossible, and even more, I would actually be afraid of that. Like, it seems like a bad, it seems scary to think that I would be happy with something that needs work. Like, you do need to clean your house. Like, it's not good to sit in filth, for instance. So, like, I was struck by how, like, afraid I was of finding contentment or happiness in something like that. Mm. And this fear that if I would, like, relax for a second and not have this, like, intense amount of pressure on myself, that would lead to, like, complete collapse. So I'm struggling with how to deal with that.
So the fear is around just, like, the contrast of that kind of energy you rally to be able to do these kind of mundane tasks. Tell me more about the fear.
I guess that if I didn't feel that pressure, like, I simultaneously acknowledge that I put way too much pressure on myself and that leads to immense suffering. But the idea that I should not have that pressure to do that I should not look at, you know, a dirty, smelly sink or something and think, oh, I gotta clean that. That seems like something that would not be a good reaction to that. Like, that seems like it would be like a dangerous reaction to that in my mind. So I can't even envision a world where I don't have that pressure on myself.
Yeah. I guess the question is, you know, what motivates us to do things? You know, what's that energy? And if it's always the sense of obligation or duty or chores, that's a certain stance on things. You know, but yet there can be a quality of joy around it. And sometimes it helps to kind of put an overlay on it, like maybe anticipating it's an act of generosity or how it's going to make the space more pleasant. You know, there's a kind of a sense of engaging in that way. But the pressure, that part, I think would be interesting. What I would suggest is just bring that into your foreground of your practice. What's this pressure that's driving my actions, driving me wanting to, how I have to use that pressure in order to do my tasks? Not try to get rid of it, not try to get to shift it into happiness at doing the floor and the soil linens, but more of that, okay, what's that actually that stance like? And what I mean by that is, like, okay, what's the body's experience of it? What's kind of the subtext or the perception that's driving that? And just to get to know that a little bit more. And then by doing that, you might start to see it in a more full way and also see maybe there's other possibilities of how to engage around these kind of scratch records, floor dirty.
Right, that aren't really as black and white, basically.
Yes, yeah.
Thanks.
You bet. Okay, so go ahead, Walid.
Yeah, thank you, Tim, for a very engaging and captivating talk and a beautiful poem. I particularly like the image of the clear sky holding the moon as a metaphor for how it feels to be doing all of this. I have a very specific question, and it might be another side of the previous question. I find that the practice really helps me a lot in taking the edge out of a lot of reactions. And that's very helpful. And your remark about Viktor Frankl's book, you know, that the place where we have control is that space between receiving something and reacting to it. And my question is about, like, I found myself slowing down my reactions. It's almost like my interpretation of some of the aspects of the practice is a little bit cheating. I use slowing down by, you know, kind of stopping my first reaction and giving my time to think about things, and then to respond to them, which I think in most of the time is good, but I do have one problem that gets in the way of things. And that's where my question is, which is sometimes, it's not good to slow down. If there's an unfolding situation and somebody is being verbally abusive, for example, and you want to stop them rather than to think through, you know, whether, you know, what judgment I should be making about the situation, if any, or something, you know, dangerous physically is happening and you want to respond to it quickly. You know, speed was never kind of like an issue for me in the past, but with this, my way of applying the practice, I feel like, you know, whatever it is that I'm doing to interpret it, involves slowing down a little bit, which most of the time is good. And maybe with time that slowing down will go away. You know, that's quite conceivable, but what do I do in the meantime, to make sure that I can manage what I perceive as slowing down as I'm applying the things that I'm learning?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. One thing to consider is that the slowing down that you've talked about, that when your first reaction, your first impulse, you kind of pause with that, you get to know where that's coming from. You get to say, okay, is that really a compassionate or kind or wise response? That process is actually, there's a lot of learning that's happening. There's a way of you're changing slowly the kind of default settings or the channels of action. They're starting to change into something that's more skillful. And often we slow down because there's confusion. There's kind of, we're not sure. We have our own, you know, hit it personally and we're not quite sure because we're kind of coming from our pain versus a place of wisdom. By doing that, though, we're kind of clearing those channels. So then when action needs to happen very quickly or almost spontaneously, it's more likely to come from that place of clarity, that more place of kindness. And it's also, you can start to trust, when you have to act quickly and immediately, you can kind of sense, where is that actually coming from? Is it coming from a place of my heart, or just like the urgency to act in a clear way? Or is it coming from a place of fear or anger? Now, that might be part of the picture, but there's kind of a clarity of knowing. So what I'm saying is that by practicing slow like you're doing, you're actually learning how to act quickly, you know, without having to ponder it or to kind of go through it. So you kind of trust that. And also at the same time, there's a passivity that can sometimes come in. And okay, I'm using the practice to kind of delay acting. But when it's clear this needs to happen right now, yeah, just trust that you can, that it's going to come forth. And I remember when I was, my daughter was in a birthday party, in the backyard, and there was this swing going, and this toddler was walking in the path of the swing. And the first, it swung and it barely missed him. And then myself and this teenager, we both got up and I grabbed the kid, you know, in the space of the swings coming up before I came down, and he stopped the swing. And that wasn't something I like, oh, fear. You know, it's just like this, the body just moved and acted. And if, you know, you start to trust that, you start to trust that capacity. And then you can also learn from it too. Like if someone says something and someone's being abusive and you step in and you say, no, that's not acceptable. You know, it may be kind of mixed for a while. It might be a bit mixed. You can learn afterwards and kind of realize, okay, there was a part of that was really proactive. There's a part of that was maybe a little off. And so in kind of a, in a retro fashion we can go back and look at that experience and also learn from it. So trust the learning is really kind of rewiring you, changing those potential pathways. All right, so maybe one or two more questions if there's anything or a comment sharing. All right, Dave.
There's an experience, well, this might be an impossible question. There's an experience I'm having. I wonder if you can tell me if this is sukha or not. So I'm trying to affect the world in many ways, caring for people that are mine to care for. And then that ultimately is imperfect and impermanent and things go wrong. So then when I look inward, I have the intention to find happiness. I find there's like, it's like a campfire, and I can like feed it with acts of sila and metta, and that's feels like enough. Is that sukha?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. That's kind of some of the things that support happiness or the sukha we're talking about is acts of intentionality, of non-harm, of kindness, of generosity, and reflecting on those. And that starts to build that inner quality of happiness and reflecting on that. Because that happiness is you also have that, sometimes there's this happiness of blamelessness too. I really wasn't not intending to cause harm. And my intentions are of non-harm, of kindness, and my actions flow that way. And so sometimes, you intend it and it's actually harmful, but then you learn from that. Yeah, but trust that inner, that campfire there.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. All right, anyone else before we close? All right, we've got Braden in the back. They got their own mic.
Going back to the question of joy versus happiness, kind of the way I've been understanding it is on a couple levels. One is kind of like a time frame where joy is a little bit more short-lived, brought about by the current moment, and happiness is a little bit more long-term, a little bit more persistent, and kind of a synonym for each, I guess I could say. Joy is a little bit more akin to like satisfaction, where happiness is kind of more akin to like contentment. Am I on the right track there?
I think it's worth exploring that some more and kind of sensing into that, feeling into that. I think both of them have, I would say that they both have a timeless quality to them, from the Buddhist perspective.
Right.
Any of these words that we've translated, we have a whole English packaging that comes up around them, what they mean and our conditioning around them. But that sense of happiness is that it does have a kind of a timeless quality to it. There's a quality of it is more contentment, has more of that sense of peace, and also with that little the campfire quality too, it has more. So it's not like tranquility is kind of this real cooling quality. And happiness is like this kind of this blending of both of those energies. And when joy has a little bit more sparky energy to it.
Right. Really, thank you.
You're welcome. All right. So thank you all for your engaged questions. And this is a fun month to explore around happiness. So next month, next week.